What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. Are you secretly a little worried that a robot might be coming to take your job? I mean, you could be listening to a robot right now, and you wouldn't even know. I'm joking. But there are actually many British industries that could really do with the help of robots. And The Intelligence's resident Canadian tells us why the world just can't get enough of maple syrup. Fair enough, the stuff is good. There's more in production, but unfortunately, it's showing no signs of getting any cheaper. First up, though,
It's early morning in Myanmar. I have traveled deep into the jungles of Karenni State, and in front of me, on a dusty field, about 40 young men and women sing as they watch the Karenni flag rise.
We're not naming our correspondent for her safety.
Myanmar has been experiencing a civil uprising for 3 years since the junta overthrew the government. Kaya, also known as Karenni State in eastern Myanmar, is rugged and landlocked, with a small population of just 300,000. Yet they are used to war. It's been going on here in some form since 1947. The recruits I'm watching are led by the commander of the Karenni army. As the song ends, their hard work begins. They start a grueling morning exercise routine. There are push-ups, they hold planks. They are on a military parade ground, but these are not army recruits. They are unlikely ever to carry a gun. They are here for 2 months crash course in law. In Karenni State and across Myanmar, a whole generation has been united through the resistance to the military coup. They believe they can win against the junta, and so have started to think about what happens after victory. And one thing they will need is lawyers, judges and prosecutors who, together with the new Karenni police force, can make sure that law and order will be restored during and after the war. After the morning's exercise, I joined the law students as they had a quick standing breakfast of rice and watery dal. Then it's time for lessons. They troop into a large hall. A PowerPoint presentation beams onto the screen where a judge starts a lecture on marriage law. The lecture is long, but the judge keeps it interesting, sprinkling jokes throughout and handing out sweets. It feels relaxed, and they're even having fun. But the spell is broken at sunset. Sudden bursts of gunfire ring out very nearby. Students dive under their desk. It turns out it's just a drill, but a reminder that across Myanmar, war is still raging. This war is far from over. The junta still controls the big cities, but it's rapidly losing control over the border. Last year, in October, the armed ethnic groups known as the Northern Alliance started an offensive. They have eliminated the Myanmar army from territories along the northern border with China. And on November 11th, the Karenni army launched what they call the 11-11 campaign against the junta. Despite their small size, they boast of having captured 65 army posts since then.
This is the Burmese military ground.
This is Major General Aung Myint. He's an older but quite imposing man in charge of the Karenni army and has been since before the war. Since then, a Karenni National Defense Force was formed, which swelled his forces to around 10,000. He tells me the army now controls more than 70% of Karenni State. Their latest success was the capture of Shordol, a strategic township on the Thai border. That means Allied forces now control the entire border and are building a road as a supply route. In the months-long battle, they say they have killed 190 junta soldiers and taken dozens of prisoners. But according to General Aung Myint, the junta still has about 1,000 soldiers stationed in the central part of the state and the capital Loikaw. But he says they confined to their bases. He tells me they can only receive supplies and reinforcements from the air and surround themselves with thousands of landmines. They have essentially fortified their bases, where they can still send artillery, but General Myint's forces have pinned them down there. They don't have enough money and weapons. Otherwise, he says, they could finish them off quickly. The war has wide-ranging impacts. Hundreds of civilians, mostly women and children, lost their lives during airstrikes and shelling. Local aid agencies tell me that the war displaced more than 80% of Kaya's population. In Donaku, a nearby village, the once small farming community has received thousands of people displaced by the fighting. An administrator of the new refugee camp tells me families come here not just for food and shelter, but also so their kids can continue their education. And I saw some of these children in lessons and met their teachers. It's too dangerous to teach in the schools. Last year, the junta's warplanes targeted the school, the hospital, and the church. Instead, teachers tell me they find wherever they can to teach. Despite the hardship that comes with war, tiny Karenni is ahead of the curve, not only militarily, but also in preparing for the future. They're looking ahead. They really prioritize education. And the state was the first in Myanmar to establish an interim executive council. It's made up of politicians, civil society, and militia leaders. It's a start to become a democratic state. And that means they should be ready to get back to more normal lives if and when the war does end. Of the 40 students in the Karenni army camp, 39 passed their final exams. They hiked back over the mountains to take up their new jobs as prosecutors, lawyers and judges, for the time being in the lower courts. But as soon as they left, the camp filled again with soldiers training for a new round of attacks, because this war is far from over yet.
What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico is more than just a tropical paradise. It's an innovations paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, Puerto Rico has the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, this is the place to bring it. Find out more at investpr.org/economist.
I mean, the thing about cheesemaking is a really ancient process, and people have been doing it since millennia. And
well, have you always had this, or did you have to do it without?
I visited Nettlebed Creamery, which is a cheesemaker in the Chiltern Hills in Oxfordshire.
Vinjera Mukandawire is a Britain correspondent at The Economist.
I was shown around by the founder, Rose Grimmond.
Right. If you don't mind signing in here, and I'm going to need also to put in one of these. This got so dusty. What size feet are you?
Four.
Right, take one of these.
Thanks.
This opens like this.
She handed me a pair of boots, a robe, and a hairnet, and we headed into the factory to take a look behind the scenes of the cheesemaking process.
We take the van every morning to the farm and collect the milk. And I guess
there are a number of steps involved, and they have machines to help with some of those steps. For example, there's a machine that cuts curds into little pieces.
That's, I wouldn't recommend touching it. It's incredibly sharp. That
will cut. They bought a 2,000 litre vat using a grant, and they went from processing around 300 litres of milk a day to around 2,000 litres in a day. But other tasks still have to be done by hand.
I turned 2,000 cheeses yesterday by hand.
And it's sorry, a pain. How many?
Well, we'll go down soon.
The process involves hours and hours of manual labour. Machines haven't solved all of their problems.
And automation would be hugely beneficial.
If we could walk away and just, like, have robots do it every weekend.
Oh. I asked Rose how much more difficult it would be without machines.
It would be awful. He said there's already enough difficulty.
Where machines can help, they save a lot of time and effort. In a country where productivity growth has been anemic for 15 years, such gains make a difference. There's a gloomy narrative around robots stealing people's jobs, but actually, Britain needs more robots and better ones.
Okay, Vinjera, apart from the need to improve the efficiency of cheese making, why does Britain need more robots?
Because Britain has the lowest adoption rate for robots in the G7. One study estimates that Japan levels of automation would boost Britain's productivity by over a fifth. And the problem has become more acute because of labour shortages. So huge numbers of people leaving after Brexit and workers quitting their jobs during the pandemic has left Britain's bosses scrambling for workers. Warehouses are short on forklift truck drivers and builders need more bricklayers. An ageing and ailing workforce will also put pressure on employers. For example, a fifth of Britain's engineers are due to retire within the next 2 years.
Why is Britain so far behind, especially given all these pressing needs?
Well, some reasons are more tractable than others. The first is that robots are expensive, and Britain is an economy of small companies. Firms with fewer than 10 workers employ a third of the country's labour force. A lot of these firms simply can't afford to automate.
Once there's an expo that happens every year, and there's one robot manufacturer there who says that they can solve all our problems.
Rose told me that for small companies, the fixed costs of investment in robots is high. The average dairy farm in Britain is expected to earn a profit of around £50,000 this year. Yet, for a herd of 200 cows, milking robots can cost as much as £400,000 to buy and more than £20,000 to maintain each year. Uncertainty around government policy certainly played a role in dampening investment, from the upheaval of Brexit to the inconsistency of policymakers. And Britain lacks enough workers with the right skills. Engineering graduates are rarely trained to install and operate modern tools, and there are too few apprenticeships.
Are there any areas where Britain is performing well?
Well, bright spots do exist. The automotive industry in Britain has 734 robots for every 10,000 employees, and that's above the national average. And in logistics, robots lift and sort items in warehouses, for example. But most industries do trail behind.
And Vinjeri, do you see this changing in the future?
Well, the good news is that the costs of automation are falling. Doubling the cumulative number of industrial robots produced leads to their prices falling by half. That's according to ARK Invest, which is an investment management firm. And that should help accelerate the slow spread of robots in Britain. Back at Nettlebed Creamery, Rose showed me a pasteuriser that they were able to get funding for.
Cheese making should be gratifying and fun and a good place to work.
Great, thank you so much. I really appreciate this.
Rather than stealing jobs, Rose says machines would make her job much more enjoyable.
Vinjeri, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I don't want to play into national stereotypes too much here, but I need to know, how do you feel about maple syrup?
Sarah, I literally used maple syrup in a blondie recipe last week. Yeah, it's great. It's great. Sorry, for those of you who don't know, Sarah Lanyuk is a senior producer on the show and a resident Canadian in the house.
And is there any chance that you know how maple syrup is made?
I imagine that it comes from maple trees. But I don't know the ins and outs, no. Tell me more.
I mean, you're right. And it just so happens around this time of year in Canada, when temperatures hover around 0 degrees Celsius, freezing overnight and then a little warmer during the day, this is prime sap-collecting season. That's the time when trees pull water up through their roots and it mixes with the sugars that are naturally found in the tree. And then people go around and with these little tubes, they hammer them through the bark, and the tube is called a spile. And literally, they just attach a bucket to this little tube, and then you can just hear it dripping. Some of the industrial farms will actually have vacuum tubes to collect it all into one point, but then all the sap is boiled down into that golden deliciousness. Sometimes in the winter, we even pour it in the snow, and we wrap it around a little stick, and then we eat it like taffy. It's called tir. It's delicious.
That sounds like something you would do if you had excess maple syrup, fair enough. Sarah, why are we talking about maple syrup?
Oh, Ore, I'm glad you asked. As it turns out, the maple syrup industry in Canada is just booming. Poring over the numbers reveals that national production reached nearly 80 million liters in 2022, which is a staggering 54% year-over-year increase, and it's a new record for the most maple syrup ever produced in a single season, shattering the previous record set just 2 years earlier by 22%. Conversely, last year, 2023, was a bad season. But bad seasons now are still a lot better than bad seasons used to be. And in the big picture of things, over the last 50 years, the industry has grown sevenfold.
Okay, that is pretty incredible, fair enough. The one thing I do notice is maple syrup is actually quite expensive. So with production going up this much, surely we should see prices begin to fall.
Unfortunately for, you know, people using it on their pancakes or in their baking, prices aren't expected to go down. But the reason is actually kind of wild. You know how most countries have a strategic oil reserve to protect their citizens from huge fluctuations in the energy markets? Well, Canada has a strategic maple syrup reserve to keep prices from fluctuating. And the industry is weather dependent, so in a bad production year, no problem, they pull from the reserve. If demand increases a lot, again, they pull from the reserve. And this year, The Strategic Reserve made headlines because it's reached its lowest levels in 16 years to hold a measly 7 million pounds of syrup. But this has actually come about because global demand is skyrocketing and it's rising faster than Canadian producers can keep up with. And Canada does make almost 80% of the world's maple syrup. So in a big production year like in 2022, that maple syrup not only goes to servicing demand increases, but then it also goes back into Canada's strategic maple syrup reserves.
How have producers managed to boost production of maple syrup so much?
So the industry has been working really hard to meet that growing international demand, which has grown by as much as 20% in a single year recently, while also keeping that maple syrup reserve stocked. And that means they've had to do everything from increasing productivity, and over the last 10 years, maple syrup producers are getting twice as much syrup per tap. But the other part of it is obviously increasing the number of taps permitted. And that's something that is industry controlled. I spoke with Joël Vaudeville at the Quebec Maple Syrup Producers Association about that.
After an increase in international demand, an average of plus 8% per year for the last 10 years, we have authorized in 2021 and 2023 14 million taps.
So there are now more than 55 million taps producing that liquid money. But the industry is also weather dependent, and Mother Nature has also been very sweet recently, and climate change could really offer the Canadian maple syrup industry a golden opportunity.
You're really loving these maple syrup related puns. Okay, so climate change will actually be good for the maple syrup industry is what this sounds like.
It's at least a possibility because the warmer weather in places like Quebec, the biggest maple syrup producing province, could mean more better production years. And also that maple trees can now grow further north than they ever could before. However, there are also a lot of caveats to that good news for the industry. Wild weather like windstorms or ice storms can decimate an entire maple grove in any given year. And that's what they saw in 2023. Pests can also be a problem, and that's on the rise with climate change in Canada. And of course, there's the whole fire thing. Canada had its worst fire year recorded last year. But what I heard from Quebec maple syrup producers is that they are lobbying their government to try and implement a new kind of insurance to protect their businesses from those bad seasons. And overall, industry experts say it's too soon to know if climate change will benefit or hurt the industry. But in the meantime, the industry is enjoying their sweet success.
You just had to sneak in one more pun, didn't you?
Just one more.
Sarah, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Ori.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. As always, you can let us know what you think of the show by reaching out at podcast@economist.com. And we'll see you back here tomorrow.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move. By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America NA, copyright 2024.